Владимир Путин может быть лично причастен к убийству
результаты
Александра...
по делу Александра Литвиненко.
Литвиненко причастны Андрей Луговой и Дмитрий
Владимир
Кустон.
Путин, возможно, лично одобрил операцию.
Андрей Луговой назвал абсурдными обвинения в его причастности.
Это уже не театр абсурда, это уже театр теней.
9 years ago, Russian agents assassinated a UK citizen in the heart of London, most likely with the explicit approval of Vladimir Putin. That was the conclusion of a British inquiry into the death of former Russian security officer Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned in London in November 2006 after drinking tea laced with polonium, a rare radioactive isotope. It was a conclusion that was long expected, and now it's official. So what happens now? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, everybody.
And also joining us via Skype from Miami, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Habegger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome back, Karen.
Hi, Brian.
Hi. And also joining us from London is journalist Oliver Bulla, author of the book, The Last Man in Russia and the Struggle to Save a Dying Nation. Welcome back to you, Oliver, and thanks for joining us on such short notice.
My pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure, too. So I've argued on the blog and on the Daily Vertical this week that the Litvinenko killing marked something of a turning point in Russia's international behavior. It was the point where Russia truly began to go rogue, or as I put it on the blog, break bad. Months later, after Litvinenko was killed, came Russia's cyber attacks in Estonia. The following year came the invasion of Georgia. And since we've had all the stuff that's been keeping us all so busy over the past couple of years, the little green men and the annexation of Crimea, the hybrid war in the Donbass, and the downing of flight MH17. We've also had cyber attacks and everything from a French television network, a German steelmaker, the Warsaw Stock Exchange, the New York Times, the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. State Department, and the White House. Mark, I know you tend to be suspicious of calling things watersheds, but was the Litvinenko assassination one? This was, after all, the assassination of a UK citizen on UK soil. A pretty brazen move, and it seems to have been a bit of a harbinger.
Well, I think I make 2 points. One is, I mean, okay, we talk about a UK citizen. Okay, he was a UK citizen, but obviously from Moscow's point of view, he was a defector and a traitor.
But de facto a UK citizen.
He was de facto a UK citizen.
But, and de jure.
But I think that it's worth mentioning. I mean, we don't make as much of a fuss about all the Chechens who've been gunned down in Turkey and elsewhere. I mean, I think this is part of a process. Litvinenko, he's one of these figures who, in a way, like Magnitsky, has become highly symbolic and significant in of himself. But the trouble is, my concern is sometimes that we forget lots of other people fall by the wayside. But to go back to this issue of was this a watershed? I would say, actually, yes, it is. I think I put it on a slightly different term. In a way, you present it as the start of something. In some ways, I see it actually sort of as more the end of something. Let me explain. I think since then, we have, I think, seen a shift away from a rather kind of more brazen treatment of the West. And instead, what we have seen is this massive expansion in political operations. That it's about character assassination, not actual assassination. It's about poisoning the political environment rather than poisoning individuals. We've started, I think, since then, and in part, it might be very hard to know quite what's going on in people's minds, but it might be in part because actually there was, at the time and since, quite a bit of international fallout, that I think actually Russia has appreciated that a new way of warfare, one that is precisely fought out through media and lobby groups and everything else, actually is systemic and strategic rather than just simply targeting individuals, has much, much fewer risks, is cheaper. I mean, let's be honest, the polonium worth up to, $30 million? And actually maybe rather more effective. So, I mean, yes, something has changed, but I think it's rather the start of a sort of a Russian badness. I think in some ways it actually showed the Russians that maybe they needed to move on from what we might think of as much more, frankly, Soviet tactics.
I mean, I see it as a watershed in terms of what they can get away with, because the Litvinenko thing was really, if the motives, I believe, for this were domestic. I mean, the things, again, reading Oliver's piece today, the two things that jump out at me were that Litvinenko was about to testify in the Spanish inquiry into ties between Putin's inner circle and Tambov Mafia group operating in Spain, and the report he authored on Viktor Ivanov, who at the time was the head of the Federal Narcotics Services, but has had various Siloviki posts about his ties to organized crime. I think it was more about that kind of stuff. It was domestic.
I don't agree.
No?
Because I think, look, if you're going to just kill someone, you just kill them. Again, like the Chechens in Turkey. Few shots in the right location, off you scramble, professional people who came on false documentation and then who promptly disappear, lots and lots of supposition, but there's not this grand theatre. You haven't got future Duma members coming in and so forth. I think for me, Litvinenko was the Litvinenko killing was less about Litvinenko, because so what could he really say that would honestly worry or damage the Kremlin meaningfully that hasn't already been said and sort of other people aren't going to then write about. I think it was actually much more about, you know, the London grad set, much more about sort of making a big statement that precisely Russia could reach out to anyone.
Interesting. Oliver, you were indicating you wanted to jump in. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points in response to that. I mean, what's interesting, I think, about the Litvinenko inquiry and having attended most of the hearings, is I think it's pretty much certain that this was not intended to be theatrical. I don't think anyone expected the Polonium 210 to be identified. And I don't think, I mean, everything that follows from that, this astonishingly rare poison, this insanely reckless poisoning, because as soon as you use this, you leave a trail wherever you go of radiation. That was not intended to be discovered. I think this was supposed to be a mysterious, unexplained.
It was discovered by accident, as you pointed out in your piece.
An absolute, I mean, a almost miraculous scientific fluke. But once it had been discovered, all else followed. So the certainty that the judge was able to ascribe to the guilt of Lugovoy and Kovtun, which he, you know, though he used the word probably in relation to Putin and high probability in relation to the FSB, he didn't have any of that shilly-shallowing in relation to the two murderers. He said they were certain to have done it. That certainty comes about because of the polonium. Mm-hmm. However, I think it is very likely, I think essentially certain, that it was not supposed to be a demonstrative use of a rare poison. It was supposed to be a sort of almost invisible use of an undetected poison.
Meaning they wanted to get this guy out of the way because he was a threat and they weren't trying to make a statement, is what you would argue.
Well, yeah, I mean, but what is interesting about what the judge said, and I was slightly surprised by it, was he didn't rule out, but he certainly put into second place the commercial motive that seemed very convincing to me. He thought that the timing was much too tight, the connection between the Viktor Ivanov report and the poisoning. And he also pointed out that Lugovoy had been essentially seemingly sent to trail Litvinenko in 2004, so some kind of operation had clearly been in the works for almost 2 years before he was poisoned. So the argument that he was more convinced by was this was more about Putin's pride, more about punishing an inverted commas a traitor, a defector, than it was about trying to save money and to save the business deals of the right. Kremlin elite.
You don't think the Spanish inquiry, as The Guardian suggested in a piece by Anastasia Kirilenko and Alexander Goldfarb, that may have been a factor? He was in November of 2006, he was scheduled to go to Spain and testify.
I personally found that very convincing.
I found that the most compelling motive.
I think that both that and the Viktor Ivanov connections to me seemed very convincing reasons. I mean, as a rule, the people the Kremlin kills are people who are costing it money. So it seemed likely to me that would be why he was killed. But Robert Owen, and he seemed to, just certainly the way he phrased it in the report, he seemed to be sourcing this to documents that only he got to see and the rest of us didn't get to see. He seemed to think that the connection that he made to Putin and to Patrushev was more about the pride, the defector angle, the fact that this guy was collaborating with Berezovsky. So which surprised me, but that is certainly what said in the report yesterday.
Sticking with you, Oliver, I mean, my original question, do you see this as some kind of a watershed in terms of Russia's international behavior?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the Zelimhan Zandarbiev was what, a couple of years before this, with a car bomb in the Gulf, right. And that was also a very reckless assassination, killed his son and I think a couple of other passers-by. So, I mean, the idea that Putin was going abroad to kill people wasn't, as it were, new. The fact that he killed a British citizen in London was, you know, or the fact that a British citizen in London was killed is extraordinary. I don't think we need to read too much into the fact that this hasn't been repeated. I think one killing with polonium-210 goes quite a long way. And people, you know, there hasn't, as it were, really been another Litvinenko. I mean, Litvinenko was sort of off the chain in terms of the allegations he was making. I don't think there is anyone essentially comparable today who's doing that kind of thing. And I mean, also, I think we need to be a little bit careful about reading too much into the expense of this poison, the sort of ideas that it costs millions of dollars. Maybe it was a bit of a Berezovsky connected story. I mean, certainly since Russia makes it, it essentially makes it anyway. It doesn't really cost anything. If it wants to use it to kill someone, it can may as well use it to kill someone as for anything else.
Mm-hmm. Karen, let's bring you in here. Yeah, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that it was a watershed in the sense that, but for what is the question? In the sense that they were, Litvinenko was one of the last people still alive who was actively pursuing his view of what happened with the apartment bombings. And when we say that Litvinenko was a one-off, he was the one polonium death, I think that's not likely. Roman Sepov, all indications are that they used the same method on Sepov. He died in the same way with massive undiagnosed radiation poisoning. He was not allowed to seek treatment abroad. He couldn't get abroad. And Yuriy Shchukin as well. So here are three people who, beginning almost immediately in the early Putin presidency, would not stop in their efforts to seek some kind of investigation of what really was going on with the apartment bombings. Of course, there are other aspects to it. But when we say it's a watershed in the sense that there was a great evil at the core of this regime that brought Putin to power. And it needed to be cleaned up. That's what Patrushev's role in all of this always is. Patrushev, when the Kuchma tapes came out, flew all over Europe buying up copies and got them all except for the ones in Ukraine. So it's I think, very telling that Litvinenko, of course, had many things on Putin and went down many avenues to try to get him. But I do think that the apartment bombings are a singular event of such magnitude. Regimes, even the worst regimes, don't come to power this way. And so his unwillingness to go quietly into the night made him a real target. I would also say that I agree with Mark that for the Putin regime, once Litvinenko was early on branded as a traitor, it made no difference whether he had obtained subsequently so-called protective British citizenship. If anything, it only increased their determination that they would deal with their own. He was regarded as their own. He had been a traitor. That's, you know, one of the three categories: friends, enemies, and traitors. And traitors are dealt with, period. And we now, of course, also have reason to suspect that Perepolichny also may have been poisoned in London. So Litvinenko is not an N of one, in my opinion.
So you think there were other polonium poisonings out there that we just don't, that it's just because, as Oliver pointed out, this was discovered by a miracle of an accident and a miracle of science.
Yeah, and you know, it is very interesting to read the scientific report that is within the longer report that was issued. It really is quite astonishing that it's an accident, a fluke, that they managed to find it. The pathologist, the British pathologist, had done his PhD on polonium, despite the fact that there had never been, prior to that, a single case of polonium poisoning in the UK.
Mm, yeah.
So, and while Of course, the Russian coverage of this uses the word "возможно" and all of that. And there's, Peskov talks about this is, wry British humor, the entire report and the way it's framed. Well, the scientific analysis of what had to be done in order to produce a weaponized polonium involves a lot of people who are very close to Putin. Mm. So I think if you just look at who was in charge of this lab, how, because it's not a matter of just taking the raw material from the lab that produces polonium, it has to be weaponized. And who is in charge of the agency that does this? No other but Vladimir Smirnov, mm-hmm. one of the Ozuradachi right. people, and a real mobbed up guy. So we have to really be quite clear that the word probably was used, but that only replies to the actual nod right. from Putin. This was a state organized and carried out assassination.
Now that's interesting, Carrie. I mean, because you bring up the apartment bombings, which I mean, it's kind of like this is the Putin regime's original sin, if you will. And I mean, I covered those bombings. I was working in Moscow at the time for the Boston Globe, and I covered those bombings. And very few people had serious doubts once they started looking into it, especially as the thing progressed. What actually happened there? What about that, Mark? Do you think this is a plausible motive?
I suppose my issue, and it's not that I actually sort of know the answer or would even think to pretend to, but this is not a regime that in a way seems to worry about evidence and facts about its activities. This is a regime that really it gets to largely control the information space within its own country. It freely and frankly lies and denies to everyone else. Given that, there is no way that, for example, Litvinenko or anyone else could have pulled out, a mobile phone clip of Putin saying, yes, we bombed those apartment buildings and we got away with it, ho, ho, ho. Something that, perhaps would have been so absolutely smoking gun.
No, but as Karen points out, others that have been pursuing this line of inquiry, Shikashinkin and others, have been whacked.
But we have to assume. I mean, firstly, these are not necessarily people who only were doing that. If you're the sort of person who is willing to go into this, let's face it, very, very mine-strewn territory, then you're the sort of person who's anyway going to be looking into all kinds of stuff and making a lot of enemies.
But the common denominator is they all were looking into this.
Well, sure, but one could pull together a bunch of other people who are looking at other sort of issues and also have been whacked. I mean, look, it may be. I suppose I just find it hard to believe that the regime was so concerned. Anyway, once they got away with it, they got away with it. This is not, to me, a regime that cares that much about what's known and what's not known out there.
Yeah, and on the motive, I mean, it's going to be speculation. Oliver, you want to jump in here before?
Yeah, I'm a bit nervous on the motive, just because I heard so many witnesses at the inquiry ascribing the motive for this killing to be whatever it was they personally were interested in. So, the Italians said it was his work on the Italian mafia. The Chechens said it was his work with the Chechens. There were people talking about organized crime, the apartment bombings. He spoke about so many different things with so many different people. And I think it's important not to, as it were, with the benefit of hindsight, overanalyze the significance of what he was saying at the time. I mean, I had a copy of his Blowing Up Russia on my bookshelf in Moscow, and I didn't open it till I was writing an article about the inquiry. I think a lot of what he said gained significance because he was killed. He wasn't someone who was, I think, certainly I was living in Moscow then. I didn't know anyone in Moscow who really considered him to be a reliable source on anything, because he was so wild in the allegations he made. And that's why I kept coming back to this idea that this was about money, that this was about the fact that he did the one thing he really did know, were these connections between Putin and the St. Petersburg mob and the gangsters in Spain. And this was genuinely harmful, potentially very costly information if it came into the wrong hands. So that was why I was so convinced by the Viktor Ivanov connection, and why I'm sort of, like Mark, less convinced about the apartment bombings connection, just because a lot of that stuff had been said before, and like you say, Putin had got away with it.
Right. Well, yeah, on the motive, we're going to be it's going to be speculation and nothing more, I guess, on this, because we're just not going to know. What I want to move on to is what happens now. The question I posed at the very outset, I want to kind of to put this in context. There are two interesting pieces I came across on this today. One by Peter Pomerantsev, a frequent guest on this podcast, a piece in Foreign Policy. So Putin killed Litvinenko. Carry on. And this is basically his argument that nothing is going to happen because of all of the Russian money in the city of London and in the London property market and so on and so forth. Nothing's going to happen. It was Peter's very sobering and depressing and I hope not accurate account. Another is a very interesting piece written by Julia Yoffe today in the New York Times, Alexander Litvinenko and the Banality of Evil in Putin's Russia, where she argues that this regime is beyond has lost the capacity to shock us. I just want to read from her closing, which I also read in today's Daily Vertical. At a certain point, the violence becomes background noise. Revenge, even when it's served up with rare radioactive isotopes, is just another detail in a picture that darkened ages ago. Therefore, nothing's going to happen because this is all fallen into this whole litany of things that just don't shock us anymore. What do we think? Is there going to be, I guess since you're in London, I'll stick with you, Oliver. I mean, what is the reaction inside the UK on this? I know there's pressure for sanctions on one hand, but yet the Foreign Office doesn't want to jeopardize relations with Russia in lieu of the negotiations on Syria. What's your take?
I'm a big fan of Peter's. He's a friend of mine. And this is actually an argument that I've made in the past. I'm actually not as convinced by it as I once was, the idea that the reason Britain doesn't do anything about or doesn't do anything much to stand up to Russia is because we're so dependent on Russian money. There isn't actually that much Russian money here compared to Chinese money or German money or American money. Russia just isn't that big an economy. It isn't really big enough to make a massive difference to the
London. But it's a big enough kleptocracy that so much stolen money is
well, there's a fair bit, but I mean, in terms of its weight in the London property market, it's nothing compared to the Chinese money or the mainland European money or whatever. So, I mean, the idea that we are essentially being swayed as a country by estate agents is one that I mean, I don't think we should read too much into. I think were that to be the case, I think Britain certainly wouldn't have pushed as hard as it did, which surprised me and surprised a lot of people, for sanctions against, you know, the Ukrainian and Russian insiders after the Crimean annexation. I mean, I think that there is an element of what exactly is there more that could be done, really, in terms of in relation to the government in Moscow. I mean, it's not...
Well, sanctioning Putin, for one, that would have incredible symbolic value.
Well, I mean, that would be pretty extraordinary, though. I don't know what the legal position on that would be. You know, there are sort of sanctioning family members and so on, but the legal position on sanctions in the EU is different to what it is in the US, in that it works the other. You have to prove, you can be challenged, and you have to prove wrongdoing. You can't just go ahead and do it in the same way. So I don't know. I don't know if the reason why Britain has been backward in responding to this, I would be surprised if it's a sort of out of concern for the feelings of estate agents. I don't think they weigh that strongly in our government's calculations. However, I do think that, you know, Syria is a major issue at the moment. We've got a big referendum coming up in this country. Anything that can try and improve the situation with refugees is likely to help the government's case in the referendum. I think these are the kind of considerations they're more likely to be thinking of and less likely to be worrying about the top end of the property market, frankly.
Mark, what's your take?
Yes, I very much. I think I'd agree with Oliver. I mean, we have to come back to this issue of, well, yes, individual deaths have symbolic factor, but you know, if one thinks how many people are dying in so many different places, how far can one actually say, well, okay, this is sufficiently important that we need to sacrifice something that might have an advantage elsewhere? At the moment, like it or not, there is advantage. I mean, even something with the fact that no one can negotiate Assad out of Syria, conceivably and potentially, other than Russia. So there are various reasons why the West needs Russia, like it or not. And then there's also distinct limitations on what practically can be done. Sure, there could be sanctions on Putin or similar, and that would perhaps make Britain feel good. But it's hard to think that it would actually have any material impact. so many of these sanctions, that the options that are left now, after all, given that we've already used the sanctions tool quite a bit, actually are more symbolic than actual. I mean, one of the other ones that's being talked about is, well, you know, kick out suspected Russian spies. Well, the irony is actually, from the security services point of view, they would rather actually keep the spies they know as spies so that they can watch them, rather than expel them to get a moment's feel-good diplomatic hit. But then know that there's going to be a whole bunch of new spies sort of seeping in one way or the other.
And British spies would be expelled from British, yeah. British diplomats, whether they're spies or not, would be expelled from London.
Precisely. But final point I'd make, I mean, so I think we're going to see some symbolic stuff, but probably not else. But I think we also actually have to recognize that, look, it's not as though up to this report we had no idea that Putin was behind the Litvinenko killing. That was always the assumption.
But
this is
now it has an official impromptu.
Yes, I know. But, really, do we honestly need it? The interesting thing is there have been actions taken. If one goes back to, for example, following the Russian refusal to extradite Lugovoy and so forth, actually Britain did impose a whole variety of, breaking with sharing of intelligence and so forth. I mean, there were practical sanctions applied at the time. So it's not as though Britain has simply done nothing at all. Actually, in the past 9 and a bit years, there have been actions carried out. But precisely, most of them were relatively small-scale, but actually practical ones, rather than nice big showstoppers.
And also, as Oliver points out in his piece, there was a lot of reluctance on the part of the British government to even open this inquiry, for fear of harming relations with Russia. It was only after the annexation of Crimea, when there wasn't much to salvage anymore, that they finally agreed to do it.
Of course, I mean, from a state's point of view, there is no real advantage. As I said, they haven't learnt anything they didn't already know.
Hmm. Well,
and now, to an extent, they are locked into a certain sort of drama about having to act and the result of it.
Karen?
Well, I mean, if not that, I think that I don't think the points that both Oliver and Mark made aren't well thought out. But I do think that we have a real situation with Russia that requires a lot more than hand wringing, and this is the way politics goes responses. I mean, first of all, there's a very big difference between German money in London and Russian money in London. That's not to say that individual Russians shouldn't be allowed to buy property in London. But if it is money that is coming through limited liability shell companies with 7, 8, or 9 iterations of burying deep and is contributing to the erosion of rule of law societies, then irrespective of whether it's Chinese, Russian, or German, there should be a much more robust fight against it. The film that was aired on the BBC, From Russia with Cash, by Roman Borisovich, playing the role of a minister, Russian minister of health, in which 5 out of 5 British realtors were willing to help him bury the money, this should encourage all of us to wake up. This isn't just a British problem. It's an American problem too, which we see the Department of Justice is beginning to address with targeted programs in the next year in Miami and in New York. It's a very good move. And we shouldn't see it as targeting just the Russians. We have to target the use of real estate as an unchecked means of laundering money. Over half of the world's money is now in the illegal sphere. That needs to be to be dealt with. And when we have a state, this is the difference between the German money and the Russian money, the German money and the Chinese money. When we have states that are complicit in this because they want both to allow their individual friends to launder money, but also to weaken rule of law adherence, then it is a very huge challenge to us, and it absolutely needs to be fought. It's a Russian challenge. They want to do it from the Kremlin down. So I think that really we need to look at this as a major issue.
No, I think everybody agrees that that's a bigger issue. I think, in fairness to Oliver, I think your point was that the volume of Russian money isn't enough in and of itself to sway Russia, to sway Britain from not imposing sanctions.
I agree with absolutely everything Karen said. I mean, she's absolutely right. This is incredibly urgent. There are a few more urgent issues. I'm just not sure whether that on its own it convinces the British government. I think it's something we should do anyway in terms of getting these murky corporate vehicles out of British property or any property.
Everybody's
any
property.
You know,
But Oliver, when we say that we need to be very active in doing this, when we have Prime Minister Cameron today saying that actions were taken at the time of Litvinenko's death, this to me is an absolute indication that nothing is going to happen. I mean, what is it that has to happen in Britain before the British government responds?
Mark, I know you want to jump in here.
Well, again, I mean, like Oliver, I mean, absolutely, I agree, Karen, that this is an issue, but this is not, as it were, a Litvinenko issue. This is something that should be done regardless of who was behind the Litvinenko murder.
Sure.
And likewise, I mean, I think in a way there is an issue, because if we make this somehow a sort of a Litvinenko-related story, then it misses the point that this is actually about Britain and indeed other countries simply doing what they're meant to be doing.
It's as much about us as it is about the Russians.
Precisely. I mean, I think this is, sure. I mean, in so many ways, the Russians just simply hold up this mirror to our own imperfections as they gleefully exploit them. I mean, the Litvinenko case was a sort of a classic bit of international evil, no question. But at the same time, the whole issue of cleansing our financial system, the whole issue of not allowing all these different sort of avenues for dirty money to flow around the world, Russian or whoever, I think it is something that we should disaggregate from that.
All right, before we move on to the next section, I just wanted to get your brief thoughts from everybody on, like, what is the significance of Litvinenko? I asked if it was a watershed at the outset. Set there are different opinions about that. What is the significance of this? The Litvinenko assassination was what? Anybody?
I think in the sort of astonishing, bizarre combination of extreme professionalism and total incompetence, it is a very good way of characterizing the Putin regime. The fact that they were able to produce this unbelievably rare, extremely dangerous and deadly radioactive isotope, and then gave it to Dmitry Kovtun, this failed
former porn star.
He wanted to be a porn star, but he couldn't keep off the source long enough. I mean, it's just, you know, you couldn't script it, you couldn't make it up. It is everything about Putin that is terrifying, is that how do you predict what someone who's going to do that will do next? You can't. I mean, it's just unimaginable.
I loved your description of Lugovoy in your piece, Oliver, where you said he's the kind of Russian that Londoners laugh at, but not until they take his money.
And not to his face.
Not to his face. Mark, what about you?
I mean, I sort of agree. How do you top that? I think it is about the theatre. It is about, I mean, yes, of course, they didn't necessarily think that the polonium was going to be uncovered, but it became a story as soon as Litvinenko fell ill. And in some ways, I think that it was just as good for them to have him dying mysteriously with no one really knowing why, as if he'd had a curse on him, as if he had some obscure radioactive isotope within him. And I think this very much shows how the Russians see things in terms of effects. I mean, there's a whole sort of jargon of what's called effects-based warfare. But likewise, I mean, I think for the Russians, they're thinking about, well, what impact will this have? It's not just about killing one individual. It's about shaping a whole narrative. And I think we've seen this in so many different ways since.
Mm. Karen?
Well, I mean, if we go back to your question about watershed, I think it is not the beginning, but it is the first time the West was put on notice that the Putin regime does not stop at the Russian borders. Mm. It will do what it needs to do, even if it undermines principles of sovereignty, principles of international law. And it was a pretty horrific act in and of itself, but its symbolic value. Everyone who now speaks against the Putin regime, every opposition figure, now understands that if they want to, they will get them wherever they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, on that note, we will shift gears. In a few moments, we will shift gears and look at the latest antics of Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov and what they pretend. I would like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Miami, Ohio, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Haviger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Also joining us from London is journalist Oliver Bulla, author of the book, The Last Man in Russia and the Struggle to Save a Dying Nation. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Разобьет всех неверных врагов. Ты великий Рамзан человек. Ты на подвиг за веру готов. Кадыров Рамзан. He's called Vladimir Putin's foes enemies of the people. The speaker of his rubber stamp legislator called the liberal media outlets Echo Moskvy and Dosh TV traitors in a fifth column. And Ramzan Kadyrov upped the ante with an article in the pro-Kremlin daily Izvestia calling Russian opposition figures jackals and suggesting they be placed in psychiatric hospitals in Chechnya, where he promised to double the dosage on their injections. And today, Kadyrov held a mass rally in Grozny that was eerily reminiscent of the one he held back in December 2014, 2 months before Boris Nemtsov's assassination. So, Mark, has Kadyrov jumped the shark? Is he right on message, as I suggested in a blog earlier this week? And given what happened last year, isn't this all a bit ominous?
I actually see this as being Ramzan trying to ensure that he gets his cash, to be perfectly honest. Again, you know, it all tends to come down to money. Just, you know, this is a time in which actually the budget is being squeezed. Chechnya, its regional budget is 81, I think it is, percent dependent on the federal budget. There's going to have to be cuts, and I think he wants to make it clear that he doesn't want any of the cuts to be falling on Chechnya, and therefore I think he's doing a combination
of
things.
Don't take my money or else?
Well, I think what he's saying is, on the one hand, look how loyal I am. Look how extraordinarily loyal I am. Secondly, he's saying, look how I can mobilize. I mean, look, this protest, I mean, who knows how many were actually there? We've had claims of a million or 700,000, but the population of Grozny is what, 300,000? Population of all of Chechnya is something like 1.3 million. So, you know, I mean, there's a claim that, you know, maybe half the entire population of Chechnya was in one square. I mean, however ridiculous.
All carrying signs calling for the arrest of Navalny and Yashin.
Yeah, I mean, it is basically the little North Korean corner.
Of North Korea.
Of Russia. And I think, so he's trying to say, look, I'm loyal, I can mobilize. And he's also more or less saying, but at the same time, you know, I am someone who shouldn't be challenged. I mean, this is, I think, one of the reasons why the whole sort of current antics, he's basically, in some ways, he's actually calling the Kremlin's bluff. He's going well beyond, as it were, the usual bounds of etiquette, in a way that, frankly, I think actually embarrasses and is awkward for the Kremlin. I don't think there's any advantage from the Kremlin's point of view.
Although it's been silent, except for Peskov saying, oh, we shouldn't, you know, chill out about this, it's no problem.
I mean, because they're, in some ways, I think that they are terrified. They certainly don't have the will, or they're not getting, I mean, in a way, it would take the guy at the top to actually say, yeah, it's okay to denounce Kadyrov.
And he wouldn't do that even after the Nemtsov assassination.
Exactly. I mean, I think I have no idea if it's fear, man crush, or whatever it is. but for whatever reason, Putin is still willing to be the only person, but nonetheless the most powerful person in Kadyrov's Krisha.
Now, this is,
and so in that case, what on earth could Peskov say?
This is coming a year after the Nemtsov assassination. This sequencing of what he's doing is reminiscent of what was going on before the Nemtsov assassination. Is there an all or else here?
I don't think there's quite a sort of a carefully articulated or else. I think it is much more that this actually fits in more with the budget cycle. Mm-hmm. And God, how dull is it to actually manage to turn
you've,
a,
Mark, you've turned the discussion about Kadyrov to the budget.
I can only apologize to you and to all of you, the readers, listeners, out there in the end. I think it's combination. And again, it is classic Kadyrov, particularly in this sort of very distinctive mix of the astonishingly crude, but actually quite wily, that he presents, you know, the many faces of Kadyrov. Kadyrov, I can be your best friend and your toughest supporter, through to the, I can also be your biggest nightmare.
Hmm. Oliver, you're indicating you wanted to jump in.
I don't think it's boring to bring this to the budget cycle at all. I think it's absolutely crucial. You know, this is... The economic crunch is only really striking Russia now, and you know they're nowhere near the bottom of what's coming, with the oil price, you know, hovering around 30 and the ruble hovering around 80. There are going to be some very, very tough choices.
Both have recovered today.
Well, I mean, the ruble soared up to 79 or something, isn't it? I mean, but it's, you know, I mean, but still, things are bad, and things are going to get worse, and there are going to be some very, very tough choices about where that money's going. And frankly, the only reason why Chechnya was pacified is because they gave Kadyrov a blank slate to kill as many people as he wanted and gave him as much money as he wanted. And if suddenly the money isn't available, then we're in uncharted territory. Who knows what's going to happen? And that isn't just happening in Chechnya. That will be happening, you know, in Dagestan, all across the North Caucasus, all over Russia to a greater or lesser extent. And I think this is actually very significant. And I think you're probably right. I think this is... Kadyrov's always been very good at playing the game of playing off the Chechens against the federal center. You know, I think he's getting his retaliation in early about the budget priorities that are going to be made. I think we're likely to be seeing quite a lot of this kind of thing from regional elites, which is something that we haven't in a way seen since the 1990s. This clash between Moscow and the regions, you know, which is what comes about when there isn't enough money to pay everyone off.
What about that, yeah. Karen? Is this what he's doing? He's saying, give me more money or else?
Well, of course, it's much more fun to imagine that he's unhinged. and discussion of the budget doesn't preclude that. But I do think it's important to follow the oil. So on the Chechen government website, there's been open discussion of Kadyrov's request to Putin to ask Rosneft, in other words, Igor Sechin, to hand over its Chechen subsidiary, mm-hmm. Chechen Neftekimprom, for them to run themselves. And it is evidently the case that this has in fact happened. So, you know, getting out your attack sheepdog and talking about injecting opposition, I guess pays for him.
So it's give me the money and the oil.
I think, and particularly given Putin's own criticism over the last year of Sechin and his avarice in the face of dire straits in the Russian economy. So it's a bit of a loss for Sechin. The other thing that's important to think about when we look at this display of amazing venality combined with aggression from Kadyrov is that, you know, what's the other side of it that he's pushing against? Why is he feeling the need to do this? Is it really the case that perhaps that Putin is in fact under threat, and or that he believes it to be the case, and that he's fighting against people like Sergei Ivanov and others in the FSB who are rumored to be increasing in their power vis-a-vis, let's say, Zolotov and Kadyrov. Yeah. So I think that there's some rationality behind this, in addition to just the fun craziness of Kadyrov. But having said that, I wouldn't like to be in the Russian opposition and watching Kadyrov from Moscow.
Yeah, no. And you mentioned you took a look on the Chechen government's website this morning just to get a sense of the flavor of the demonstration. I took a little time and watched the Russian language Chechen state television program. It makes Pervy Kanal look like the BBC. I mean, it take a look sometime. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Oliver, I know you need to leave us, unfortunately. And thank you for redoing your schedule to be with us this far. What are your thoughts on what Karen said? This might be as a result of Kadyrov sensing that the people, his supporters in the Kremlin, are losing power.
Yeah, Kadyrov has always been very good at playing people off against each other and strategically murdering people in order to make sure that his rivals have got out of the way. I mean, it's worth saying, I mean, you know, that there are obviously things going on behind closed doors and shifting tectonic plates in the Kremlin and so on. But who is the alternative to Kadyrov is the thing. You know, if they were to remove Kadyrov, who would they replace him with? He has successfully, I mean, you know, in the 2000s, there was a clever sort of, you know, the clever Yamadayev Kadyrov clans were kept separate and equal. But you know, he's successfully solved that problem by essentially whacking them all. There isn't any rival to him left in Chechnya at the moment. And in fact, large chunks of Chechen society who would mobilize in favor of any kind of rival have left. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Chechnya reporting on it and writing a book about it and so on. Almost every single Chechen friend I have has left. You know, it is a place that has been denuded of anyone who's prepared to essentially put their head above the parapet. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to imagine how anyone could engineer a post-Kadyrov Chechnya without taking the ultimate measure and just killing him. And I don't think that anyone's prepared to really go down that route. So it's a real mess.
Mark, I know you're skeptical of the notion that although everybody believes it, and that's what makes it real, that removing Kadyrov from the scene would create chaos in Chechnya and beyond throughout the North Caucasus. Am I correct in that you're skeptical?
Yeah,
about that?
I mean, I think that, I mean, although I agree absolutely with Oliver that there is no obvious candidate, I suspect that sort of if they did try to remove Kadyrov, I think the first candidate would be someone who'd be parachuted in.
The return of Doku Eroportovich, remember him?
Well, yeah. Well, I still think time for a viceroy of the Caucasus again.
I don't know. Keep your eye on Zakayev. You never know. He's prepared to play games.
Yeah, exactly. I understand that nice Mr. Sorkov might well be still looking for a new position soon. But I mean, I think two things I'd mention. I mean, one is, I mean, take for example this business of the oil business being transferred to Chechnya. I mean, very much I see that as being essentially a bit of a shell game, in the sense that the federal center is hoping to be able to do that and then be able to say to the other regions, you see, we've even cut the amount of money we give to the Chechens, because, as it were, they can reduce the actual straightforward federal budget subsidy, knowing that the oil business picks up the shortfall. Mm-hmm. So it's still a way of paying off Kadyrov. And I think this is the point, that actually in so many ways, Kadyrov is to Putin what Putin is to the West. That he's the guy who pushes the boundaries, goes beyond them, and then more or less says, so really, seriously, what are you going to
do about it?
You know, ultimately, firstly, you need me, and also you actually have very few levers on me. And so although I'm not for a moment shedding tears for Putin, but certainly there's a lot of other people in Moscow who are sitting there thinking that they would love to have a plan B.
Hmm.
I mean, one thing I think has been noticeable about Chechnya under Putin is that things that happen in Chechnya have a tendency of happening in Russia 1 or 2 years down the line. You know, it's how elections were rigged, you know, companies were taken away, dissidents were killed. Sort of, a lot of these things started out in Chechnya, were seen as extraordinary because they happened in Chechnya, and actually then happened in Russia, and it didn't seem that unusual because the ground had been prepared.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, it's certainly been, I would say, the tendency so far, and it's a bit of a worrying prospect if what we're seeing now is repeated.
Well, before we wrap it up for this week, I want to throw just one last thing at everybody. And is all this stuff we're seeing right now with Kadyrov, regardless of the motive for it and the reasons for it, is it something of a harbinger that something ugly is coming down the road? Is this a harbinger?
Yes.
Oliver. Yes. Okay. Go, Karen.
Yes. I think when you have anyone, much less Kadyrov, saying that the opposition needs to be treated as enemy of the people and calling them jackals and threatening physical harm, I mean physical elimination or forced incarceration in psychiatric hospitals, this is a message that everyone in Russia understands. And when Oliver talked about how many Chechens had left, well, look at what happened at the Gaidar Forum, where you have people like Gref getting up and saying, we lost 400,000 people last year. This is the single largest hit that our economy has taken, that we absolutely have become a downshift economy, called it, because we don't actually have the capability to recover anymore, because this has happened. So I think it is a demonstration that the state, the Kadyrov state, and then the Russian state, will do what it has to maintain itself in power.
Mark, would you agree? Is this just a symptom or is this a harbinger?
I think it's a harbinger, but in a different way. I mean, I wouldn't want to draw too close a parallel. And to be honest, I don't think Kadyrov is speaking for the Kremlin, let alone the wider elite. Quite the opposite, actually. I think there is considerable discomfort about what he's saying. What I think it's a harbinger of is precisely, and this is something that Oliver brought up before, is that really the double-headed eagles are coming home to roost about the economic crisis, which is, after all, the fundamental thing. We're seeing more and more tensions and conflicts within the elite. And particularly if you're a regional elite, and all the regions are dependent on the federal center, just simply the way that, you know, none of them have their own money. All the money goes to Moscow and then is doled out by Moscow, which means that they're all going to have to find their different ways of basically making their case. And if you're Kadyrov, you make it in a particular muscular and brutalist way. Elsewhere, it might even just simply be almost the game of pathos. Just look how terrible things are going to be if you don't support us. But one way or the other, I think we're going to see much more of a region center crisis. Mm-hmm. And so Kadyrov is the very visible one, but he is a harbinger in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Last word to you, Oliver.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that Navalny got a lot of traction with his slogan about feeding the Caucasus, that the idea that people from the Caucasus were being treated unfairly, were being given more than ethnic Russians. If Kadyrov wins and gets more than ethnic Russians in this budget squeeze, then that will play into Navalny's hands. If Kadyrov loses and gets less, then the North Caucasus will be destabilized by the elites there. It's a pretty unenviable situation to be in, frankly.
Well, on that happy note, we'll wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Skype from Miami, Ohio, has been Karen Dawisha, director of the Haviger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? And joining us from London has been journalist Oliver Bulla, author of the book The Last Man in Russia and the Struggle to Save a Dying Nation. Thank you to all of you for an enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, editor-in-chief of RFERL's Russian-language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFERL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.